Cine Marathon, the movie marathons podcast where we watch movie marathons all in one day, and sometimes more than that, and talk about them later. As you may have noticed, Dan and Jorge are not here. I'm John, Dan's brother.
I'm Matthew. I'm Dan's friend. We all went to high school together, and then why don't we go around and get some of the other introductions?
I'm Jackson. I am Matthew's roommate.
I'm Patrick McGrath. I am a friend or associate of most of the people here.
I'm Patrick O'Reilly. I'm Patrick McGrath's brother.
I'm Richard. I'm a Cancer.
These fine gentlemen and I decided to do all of the Bond movies in a row.
Actually, more than just the movies. We actually got a TV special in there, too. But
yeah, now, Matthew, why don't you explain, just so people know. I mean, we watched all the Bond movies, but exactly what did we do and what was the plan, really?
All right, well, it first started out, basically, long story short, 10 years ago, I said to my friends, hey, let's do the Bond marathon, and they were like, nope. So
ain't no friends of yours.
Exactly. But a few weeks ago, I was watching some TV with some friends during a MacGyver marathon, actually.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? Let's do the Bond marathon. And apparently these people were just crazy enough to accept. So we decided to do all 22 of the licensed Bond movies. But then we also added in the 1954 original TV special from the show Climax. It was a version of Casino Royale, starring an American version named Jimmy Bond. And then we also added the 1967 Casino Royale, directed by John Huston, with Woody Allen and Peter Sellers. And then ultimately we added the Never Say Never Again, what some would consider non-canon.
Right, it wasn't made by the same company that makes all the others. So this was the true Bond marathon.
Yes, everything that we know to be set to film or videotape, we did.
So. With the exception of James Bond Jr.
That's right.
That's true.
Yes. That's for another day. We'll do the whole James Bond Jr. series. But, I mean, really, in terms of movie marathons, James Bond's like, I mean, that's like the Mount Everest of movie marathons. You can't get much more than that.
Yeah, we really have no bridges ahead of us that should be hard to cross.
Unless we want to tackle the 34 Land Before Time series.
And the television series for that as well.
Before we get into the movies, I thought it'd be a good idea for us to all go over just sort of our level of knowledge of Bond prior to the marathon. I know I myself was a huge Bond fan, and my dad showed a bunch of me when I grew up. I hadn't literally seen all of them all the way through, but I'd seen a vast majority of them. But that wasn't the case for everybody, right?
No, definitely not.
I guess I was the only one who has actually seen every Bond movie. I've been watching the Bond movies as long as I can remember. Very, very familiar with all the plots and aspects and all the Bonds who've played Bond.
This is Patrick. My knowledge prior to the marathon of the James Bond series basically consisted of, I know I'd seen all of Roger Moore's films, or I'm pretty sure I had, but other than that, I don't know if I'd seen a Connery film, maybe Dr. No, and that would be about it. I'd seen the first Timothy Dalton movie, the first Daniel Craig movie, and like the first half of Brosnan's work, and that's about it.
I think I saw the first half of Pierce Brosnan's work, and then I saw the two latest ones. And then other than that, I think I saw like bits and pieces of other ones. So basically this whole marathon was a lot for me to absorb. I had no idea what I was in for, but definitely would not take it back. It was pretty awesome.
Hey, other Pat here. So I had never, ever seen any of Moonraker. I had heard about it, I certainly never saw any of it. I had seen about half of License to Kill. Other than that, up until this marathon, I had seen all of these at least once and enjoyed most of them when I saw them once.
And then I had seen Brosnan's movies and Daniel Craig's movies with the exception of Die Another Day. But other than that, I could not claim to have known anything prior to that. I was a total Bond poser. like, at the very best, I had seen sequences from Honor Majesty's Secret Service on TBS at 2 in the morning.
But, I mean, I think the interesting thing about Bond is, like, even whether you've seen them all or seen hardly any of them, like, everyone kind of has an idea of that character and who he is. He's such a, like, pop culture phenomenon.
Yeah, it's joined the collective unconscious.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, not everyone has done what we've done and watched them all.
I'm pretty sure we're the only ones that have done what we've done.
Not even the filmmakers have seen all of them. All right, well, let's get it going here.
Barry Nelson. Peter Lorre. Starring in tonight's production of Climax.
First one on the list was the Climax episode of Casino Royale.
Best one, number one.
Really? Number one. That's your top one?
No.
I put it number one chronologically, but that's about it.
Now, I honestly had heard of this, but actually never seen it at all. But this was a show that was like live, like,
and it was actually pretty early on in the series too. It was eventually renamed like Climax Mystery Theater, I think. But basically, it was just three act plays. The first one was like The Long Goodbye. I forget what the second one was, but they were all on like established works. It was done live, and I guess I didn't notice it when we were watching, but there was a lot of instances of like actors stepping on each other's lines and people talking off camera, not knowing they were still mic'd and things like that. But none of it so obvious as to interrupt the actor.
I think we had one moment where we thought maybe Peter Lorre was just going to town off camera,
yeah,
like coughing or something, like he was just having a hack fit,
yeah,
or something.
I think we heard that.
Well, for me, what really stands out the most was the fact that James Bond was a like 50-year-old American
howdy
guy,
bitch,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yeah, just, yeah, Mike Dicko, like, yeah, the Secret Service,
but a giant tool.
He looks something akin to Pat Sajak in a tuxedo.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Oh, yeah. I mean, I understand. It's sort of hard to like view it through the like looking glass, I guess. Because,
yeah,
I mean, now it's like everyone knows who Bond is. So iconic. So to watch this with him, an American, just, and like a shell of a man, too.
Yeah.
He's like bumbling the whole time. Like,
it looks like he's going to cry at any moment.
He's definitely not the Bond that most people think of.
And certainly half as cool as his British intelligence officer friend, Clarence Leiter,
yeah,
who is like,
oh,
the,
yeah, they
British
did a,
incarnation.
They did a double switch.
Yeah. Because, like, in the regular movies, Bond has an American intelligence officer friend who's named Felix. But in this, because Bond was American and named Jimmy, which is the coolest name ever, obviously.
Jimmy Bond.
They renamed his friend Clarence.
I wonder why they changed it to Jimmy. Like, what was wrong? Like, James is fine.
I wonder why they changed Felix to Clarence. Because I don't think that Clarence sounds any more
British
than,
yeah,
Felix does.
Well, maybe they thought that the other guy couldn't have a cooler name than Jimmy
That's
Bond.
Probably.
So, yeah.
But they were okay with making him about 10 times as cool as Jimmy,
yeah,
Bond. Like,
honestly, I feel like, for me, Clarence Leiter is actually the first James Bond.
Yeah.
Because he's like debonair British secret agent guy.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
And,
yeah,
Jimmy Bond is just kind of like,
Jimmy Bond is like pathetic. Like,
yeah,
he, because at,
yeah,
the beginning he teaches baccarat lessons
for like a good 20 minutes of a,
but
60-minute show.
Then when he gets to the table, he's like horrible. Like, he like loses like,
yeah,
20 hands in a row.
Yeah.
It's like,
it may have something to do with why I feel like after that 40-minute lesson on baccarat, I had no idea how to play. Still, and it's not that difficult a game.
Oh,
yeah,
totally.
So,
well, we,
I think,
yeah, after all the movies, I don't think a person in this room knows how to play,
no,
baccarat.
No,
not
at all. Not completely.
But apparently, Jimmy Bond didn't know how to play either. Yeah.
The one thing I did learn about playing baccarat is that if you're going to accept a phone call from your higher ups as a secret agent, you probably shouldn't talk about your mission 10 feet away from the table, where you're like, like, that is the worst secret agent like I have ever seen in my life.
The only other thing I really remember, and it was so long ago in the marathon, but they had like guns that were like cane guns.
Yes.
Yeah, that was the first gadget.
One
cane. Yeah. Yeah, which to me is such an odd choice, because like I understand, like, okay, it's a gun, and now we're hiding it, the fact that it's a gun, by making it a cane and make it like inconspicuous. But he doesn't,
by making it inconspicuous by something that's kind of shaped like a gun already. Like,
yeah, but it's not like he gets a shot off like secretively. Like, he sticks like Jimmy Bond up with it, like holds him up in front of like the whole, yeah, hotel. Like,
it would,
yeah,
have been much more discreet if he just used a gun.
Yeah.
Because people wouldn't be like, yeah, wait, why is that guy's hand touching that other guy's back? Instead, they're like, why is he poking him with a cane the whole way out of this place?
He's, yeah, holding that cane so like awkward. A gun.
We gotta remember, back in those days, caning was still an appropriate form of capital punishment.
Well, does anyone have any other thoughts about the climax fishing around?
Peter Lorre was Le Chiffre and was amazing, actually.
Yeah,
even
good.
Though, like, the production on a whole, its value was kind of low. Like, Peter Lorre has always been consistent to me, and,
yeah,
he was a really great version of Chiffre.
And the Bond girl was pretty beautiful in,
yeah,
this one, too.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I was actually, she was one of my top Bond girls, actually.
She's supposed to be like a precursor to Vesper Lynd in the two remakes, but I'm trying to remember what they changed her name to. It's like Valerie something.
She is Valerie Mathis.
Yeah, that, that's it.
Yeah.
Oh, Mathis.
Yeah.
He's in there later.
Yeah.
He's,
yeah,
in, yeah. That must be where they got the name from.
It is.
They mix a lot of stuff together for it.
Le Chiffre got his name. The name of Le Chiffre is a carryover from when he emigrated out of France. It roughly translates to the cipher or the number, and that's how he is known in the criminal underground. less of a title and more of a translation of something that he did in the old country.
Yeah. Well, I think he's actually better known for doing magic tricks and psychedelic drugs.
As Orson Welles,
but, that's
that'll be later.
Yes.
The next movie, the first like official real Bond movie, was Dr. No, and that was a pretty good start. And obviously, in the marathon, well, I think we were all doing fine then. It's like no problem, but
right.
Later on, it became a problem. But what did you guys think of Dr. No?
I really enjoy Dr. No. He is like the first incarnation of like the kind of Bond villain. He's also kind of he also has to kind of be the henchman, because usually the henchman is the one with the power, like the kind of like beyond power. And here's Dr. No, is, you know, this man with who lost his hands during his whatever experimentation he was doing, and he's got these mechanical claws. He's like non-threatening with them, but you just see them in these sweet square gloves, and he's like, God, it's creepy.
He's a Lego.
Yeah.
But he's a Lego man.
He's also the introduction into like the hospitality of the villain, you know? They're treated to like a fancy bedroom, and they're waited on hand and foot.
And poison coffee.
He brought a classiness almost to being a villain.
Yeah, I liked what John said about it. It's like someone should write like a traveler's guide to Bond villains.
Yeah.
Dr. No had quite a good dinner, and like, you know, like all of like they were so accommodating, but also evil at the same time.
It's funny because like in that movie, it's meant to be like unsettling, like Bond's, you know, in trouble, and then all of a sudden he's being like wine and dine and drugged, and you're supposed to think like why is this happening?
Yeah.
It's weird that it became such like a mainstay of the series.
Well, it was supposed to be sort of an eccentric like characteristic of one person became the entire movie series.
Yeah. Also, before we get too far into Dr. No, I think it's worth commenting on the contrast from really shoddy picture for Casino Royale, and then we go right from that to pristine Blu-ray of Dr. No.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
That Blu-ray was amazing.
Yeah.
Great transfer.
It could have been shot yesterday, practically. Like, it looked like so clear.
Another thing I remember about Dr. No, and I know we all got really excited, was Bond's buddy Quarrel takes like glass to the face.
Yeah.
Like
damn right he does.
Yes. He literally does not flinch. Like he may be the most masculine character in the entire Bond franchise.
So, one of those.
I don't know any other characters that can literally have a woman with glass in her hand slap him with the glass, cutting him down the face, and literally no emotion. He literally sat there like nothing happened, and that just blows me away. It's amazing.
But apparently his weakness was dragons, though, because he can take like women. He's like a little bitch when it comes to like a car
with some flames painted on
it. Oh yeah, it's because he was drunk.
Yeah, Pontiac Trans Am would have fucked him up.
It was all the rum.
Oh man. Yeah, that who would ever buy that as like a dragon? It's a shitty like Winnebago with like flames on the side and like
painted teeth.
Yeah.
Just also as a side note, in that scene where the girl cuts his face and he's bleeding and doesn't care, there's an extra you need to look out for, a guy dancing in the background.
The pointy dance.
He was doing like a Jimmy Durante in the background.
And he had his eyes open as wide as they would go, and he's just pointing like crazy.
Yeah.
Personally, I think the cool thing about Dr. No is like usually series take like a while to kind of find their footing, or at least like it took fucking Jason like 3 movies to get a hockey mask.
Talk about 10 movies. Did it ever get stride?
Did it ever get to the top? But like Bond is, I mean, it's like James Bond like right off the bat. Yeah. Like there's no like warm up time.
Yeah, needed. Sean Connery definitely came into it with a pretty like well rounded character in mind. Like he kind of knew exactly where the series was gonna go.
That's one thing where like if you put Dr. No after Thunderball or something, like the only reason that you would know that it was different is because he's younger.
I think Dr. No has to be one of my favorite villain lair takedowns, where Bond turns the danger wheel to the highest level.
Yeah. Why would they set it past like danger? Like, wouldn't they just let it stop before the danger?
Yeah, why doesn't it pin right at like risk?
sometimes you need to have a little bit of danger.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. Yeah.
I think another notable reference we need to make to this is how much of the Austin Powers franchise like how much how much Mike Myers took from just this movie.
Yeah.
Dr. Evil's almost his entire lair looked exactly like that. His costume,
the suits, the plastic suits.
The plastic suits.
I kind of wonder why I even thought Austin Powers was so funny having not seen any of the Bond movies, because now that I look back on it, most of those jokes really are directly.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why when Austin Powers came in, I loved it, because I was like such a huge Bond fan. I mean, it's like spot on.
What did you guys think of Ursula's performance here?
Yeah, that was Honey Rider, right?
Honey Rider, yeah.
Yeah, she was definitely, she started off strong for the hotness factor. As far as personality, let's give that a big old zero.
She just likes collecting seashells. Like
that's her livelihood.
But that's her thing. Actually, they do give her a little bit of a character, more than a lot of others, because we find out that she was an orphan who then got raped, and then gets vengeance on them by putting a black widow in her rapist's sleeping mosquito net.
It's like
I forgot about that. Yeah.
So actually, that's a pretty strong start as far as giving the Bond girls something a motivation.
Yeah. Is this the same movie where Connery is attacked with a spider in the room?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I was reading about that and how there's a couple shots where it's a really clear plate glass between him and the spider, because apparently Connery is deathly afraid of spiders. His stuntman even said having the tarantula walk on him was one of the most terrifying stunts he's ever done.
Yeah. Was the spider in the woman's apartment that he took over, or was that
no?
That was later in the movie.
No, that was later in the movie. Oh, I'm sorry. We have to mention this. The situation where Bond goes into a woman's house, seduces her, and then upon she has to leave for some other business or something.
She
gets hauled away.
Yeah, she's arrested.
In all fairness, she did try to kill him.
Okay,
he's going to meet her, and then guys try to kill him on the way.
Yeah,
and then when he comes in, she's shocked that he's at the door, he's even alive. But she still, has sex with him for whatever reason.
No, that's the best part. He knows that she's going to be arrested, and he's going to have her arrested. But he waits till after the sex.
Right.
We're going to have sex with you and then have you arrested.
Yes.
But then the real master plan hits when she gets taken away and he becomes a squatter in her house and just takes her drinks and plays a record player.
And just chills.
Yeah,
he set up that dummy, didn't he? Somebody
catches wind of the fact that he's commandeered this woman's house and they come in to kill him, and he's got pillows filling the bed, and the guy fires 6 rounds for no reason into this dummy on the bed, and then Connery's you fired your 6. Well, he shoots him once there, and then the guy collapses on the bed, and he shoots him again on the bed. Apparently he shot him 5 more times in the back in the original cut, but when they took it to the censors, they said you need to scale that back or we're going to cut the whole scene. But I think that would have been funny. It's just you had your 6, all right, now I'm going to have my 6. I'm going to shoot your dead body 5 times for no reason.
License to fuck dudes up, man.
Part of the plan.
From Russia with love, I fly to you.
All right, well, that brings us to the next movie, which is From Russia with Love.
Woo!
Very good.
Pretty good.
Richard's a fan.
Yeah, it's my number one.
Oh, really?
Oh, really?
Why is it your number one?
It's my number one for a couple reasons. Allow me to. First of all, it's one of the most complex plots. Bond is being set up. This other, the Bond girl of the story is being set up. It's all about misdirection, about trying to get their hands on this one piece of equipment. It's got one of...
Right? It's a cipher decoder.
Yeah, it's a cipher. It's the Russian cipher decoder. Yeah. And, she's supposed to be a defector, but she thinks she's working for her government as a double agent, but she's actually being set up by Spectre, and Bond's falling for it, and then when they finally realize it's too late, it's got one of the best fight scenes. To me, one of my all-time favorite fight scenes is between James Bond and Robert Shaw's character, whose name I can't remember, actually.
Donald Grant.
It is just a brutal fight. There's no choreographed karate chopping. It's just two guys going at it. One of them's going to die. And it's just either way, one of them's going to die, and they just have to go at it until it comes to that.
Yeah, but Richard's right in saying that, as far as action movies, especially from that era, it's pretty brutal. Not by today's standards, it wouldn't seem as much, but it's definitely very visceral. I agree with Richard, and that's one of my favorite fights in the whole series, actually.
If I were a director and I were directing that film, I don't know how you get your actors to have that much emotion and that much
put that much into trying to completely destroy their nemesis. They just went at it, and that was
amazing.
He
told Shaw that he was a shark. That's so unfortunate for Robert Shaw, because he's such a great actor, but like literally all I can think of is it Quint, right, from Jaws?
Quint. Yeah.
Yeah, like that's like it's a great movie, but literally all I see is like he's the sailor and he's going after the shark.
Drunkard.
Like, well, then you need to see The Sting, my friend.
Yeah. Oh, I have seen The Sting. Like, no, that's the thing. I think he's a great actor. It's just I feel like
that's always the first thing.
Yeah,
to
like
mind.
It's almost like Norman Bates or something. Like you're in that movie and now for like forever you're that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only thing I can think of Vince Vaughn playing.
Man, right? He was, yeah, he was good. Yeah. Jerking off while watching the girl.
Oh, right. Yeah.
The thing that stands out for me most of From Russia with Love, amazingly, is the opening scene where they have they like try to trick the audience, like Bond's running around in the shrubs and stuff, and then Robert Shaw just like kills the shit out of him.
Oh, right.
And you're like, oh my god, the movie's over. Like, what? And then like they rip this mask like Scooby-Doo style.
Yeah, like Mission Impossible.
Guy, like, oh, we psych. Like,
I totally forgot about that. That was amazing.
What I really want to know is like, did that guy know that he was gonna? Because he clearly kills him.
Yeah.
But he's clearly working for Spectre. He's like where's the list to sign up for that?
Henchmen have been dying for their cause.
Yeah.
Unwillingly for generations.
That's true.
He probably thought he was getting a bonus.
I was actually terrified after that happened, because I was worried that, like you said, Mission Impossible, that this was going to become like a mask fest situation where it's like, okay, none of these scenes matter because anyone could be wearing a mask and look exactly like somebody else. But apparently they had to reshoot that entire sequence because the guy, when they pull the mask off the face, the guy that they had originally didn't look different enough from Sean Connery that people would just be like, wait, what did they just peel off of Sean Connery's face? So they had to hire a guy with a mustache.
Yeah, a mustache. It was like,
to wear the mask the second time around.
Yeah. So in retrospect, Connery, no mustache.
Of course.
Guy who's killed, mustache.
Also, that's my favorite Bond girl of the series was...
That's right.
She was cute.
Tatiana.
Well, in terms of attractiveness, she's definitely way up there.
Yeah.
I think I have other girls in terms of like overall. But
well,
like,
I was grading her more on like her attitude, like going along with the whole like they take on different names because they're pretending to be married. She's like really playful in addition to being like super hot, and so that just
well,
pushed
she certainly
her over the
beats
top.
Any of those Bond girls from like the 70s.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah,
never, anybody post like 81.
Yeah. Oh, there's just like a coke fest. Like it's horrible.
Is this movie the first appearance of Moneypenny, or was it Dr. No?
Dr. No had Moneypenny, but this actress in From Russia with Love would go on to play Moneypenny for several movies.
Okay.
This is the first appearance of Desmond Llewellyn, though.
Yeah,
right?
First appearance of Desmond Llewellyn Q, and the first real gadget, cuz Dr. No didn't really have any gadgets.
The craziest thing in this movie, this has to be the only time it happens in the whole series, but Bond at the top of the movie is with like the chick from Dr. No.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I did not notice that.
There's a recurring Bond girl it's actually like continuous. It's like there's a continuity.
He taps it twice. Like.
Yeah. Never do the double tap. He learned his lesson the first time. Yeah, that's right. Because Moneypenny calls him, right? Mm. And she, and the original Bond girl, is there, and he's like trying to hide it because he's embarrassed.
Like she was in Dr. No. Like she got his like shirt on and was playing golf in his apartment. And then, like in the next movie, he's with her, like, vacationing, and she's like, oh, you gotta go. Like,
yeah.
Bond's got, like, a girlfriend.
Yeah. Inappropriate.
Yeah.
Goldfinger. He's the man with the Midas touch.
All right, well, the next movie on the list is Goldfinger. And Goldfinger's actually mine.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one, John. Goldfinger, in my opinion, has the best plot. This one, I feel like most Bond movies, the villains are just assholes to be assholes. And this one, it's amazing because Goldfinger, he's got this huge gold supply, and in order to make his gold better than everybody else's gold, he wants to raid Fort Knox, first of all, which is badass. I challenge anybody to think that's not badass. But yeah, like he raids Fort Knox to make that gold radioactive. Like, that's just genius. Like, not only are you raiding Fort Knox, but you're gonna make that gold radioactive. Like,
but there's also, not only is it in, like Jackson said, like sort of like a badass or really like interesting like scheme, it really is, if you think about it, an incredibly debilitating scheme. Like, it would destroy the world economy. Instantly making him one of the richest men in the world. Like,
if not the richest man.
Yeah, like all the other movies are holding up the country or Britain for like $5 million or whatever. Mm-hmm. And like this movie would just have like billions and trillions of dollars of like damage. Like,
yeah.
For me, I think the reason not that it's my personal favorite and I think the best one is really, I mean, forgive the pun, but it really became like the gold standard to which like all Bond movies are made. Like, stop anybody on the street who's never seen a Bond movie, and, like, everything they're going to regurgitate is, like, basically from this movie. Like, right. You have the laser, like, scene.
Yes.
Where he's getting tortured, and it's like, do you expect me to talk? No, I expect you to die. Like, everybody knows that.
Yeah.
But I love that, because he really wasn't expecting anything out of James Bond at that point. He was just like, well, I mean, that'd be cool if you talked, but I don't really... I have better things to do. I'm going to go do this. All I needed was for you to be out of my way.
Yeah, he's really, like, the smartest villain, because, like, all the rest of them were like, yes, I do expect you to talk. Like,
yeah.
I would have to say my biggest complaint, though, about the movie, it's Goldfinger's very long explanation to the American mob of how they're going to do it. And so it's like, for the audience's benefit, and then he kills the mobsters.
Yeah. For like literally no reason.
Yeah, so the whole thing was just for the audience's benefit. I mean, so I get it, but it was just like, what?
Obviously, there's no reason for him to tell him that. I mean, I explain it as like a Smallville mailbag answer. Me and my brother always say this, like the old Superman comics. That it was Superboy. They people would write in questions to Smallville mailbag, and it would always be so stupid to be like, in panel 7, like Superman's cape was blue instead of green. Like what? Like clearly they like fucked up. Like, but what was great is they would always answer with like, well, you know, there was some like red kryptonite in the air. Like they just
they would actually try and justify.
They would never admit that they messed up. Be like, my bad, like we fucked up. Like they would come up with this bullshit answer, like reverse engineering. So I call it the Smallville mailbag answer to that. I see it as like Goldfinger sort of has. Like, his biggest flaw is his ego.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, he, like, literally is just doing it to, like,
gratify. He almost wanted all these people to stand up and applaud before he killed them.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. Whoa, you know what? Bravo, dude. That's fucking great.
I do love that he designed this whole room to seal up just so we could kill him.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The fireplace closes up, the model.
One of it.
It's like, wow, he really, he's got, like, the canisters of gas that rise up out of the bar. It's just like, what if he was going for a drink and he hit the wrong button? Oh, my God.
As much as I'm heralding Goldfinger as this classic, it's this great movie, like, watching it now, especially in the opening scenes, there is, like, this is the most, like, misogynist.
He
is ever in any movie. Like, he's smacking girls' asses. And, like, this one opens with, like, he blows up some plant or for whatever reason, goes and has a drink, goes to his, like, hotel room, and then there's, like, this sexy lady in the tub, like, waiting for him, who I assume he's just, like, been fucking. And then he, like, she gets out, and they make out, and then in her eye, he sees, like, a henchman coming up, about to kill him. And we, like, I guess we're led to believe the woman's evil because she sees the henchman and doesn't warn him.
But that's
about the only clue we get. And he, like, whips her around and just uses her as a human shield.
She gets cracked in the head real good.
Oh, yeah.
I think she's knocked out while he fights the henchman. And then he just fucks off and leaves her there, like, chilling.
Well, and he also gives one of my favorite lines in all the Bond movies where, like, the henchman's in the tub and he throws the like, fan in it. And the guy just gets electrocuted.
Oh, yeah.
And then he's just like, shocking. Like, what a fucking asshole. Like, it's so good.
Yeah. That might be the best intro, I'm gonna say that. With the exception of BoldenEye.
I'll agree. Yeah.
Well, let's not forget the massacre against females that is the intro to Diamonds Are Forever. That will be coming up later. It rivals that. Yes. It definitely rivals that.
But yeah, like from square one, I mean, just like from the get-go, you know this movie's gonna be amazing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, come on.
Did we talk about Odd Job?
No.
We didn't mention him.
Oh, right.
Amazingly, no, we haven't.
Yeah, like, He is one of the greatest Bond villains. I mean, it's Odd Job. He has a fucking metal hat that he can kill anybody at any distance, no matter the wind pattern.
I'm still wondering what benefit that sort, like, what advantage does that give him? I guess it's like a concealment.
It is concealment. It is.
Yeah, I just said, why don't you just give him a gun? Like, what's the
hoopla? He doesn't throw guns. He throws hats.
Yeah.
Yeah, give him a gun to throw at people.
It's going to be a sharp gun.
One thing I was kind of disappointed was that, like, when Ajav finally faced Bond, he threw it, and Bond, like, ducked or something, and, like, that's all he did to, like, avoid
Ajav. I can't believe no one has considered that.
He's just like, I don't want to end up like that statue from Act 1.
Yeah, Bond had the brilliant idea of dodging.
Well, maybe the Oddjob's only been practicing with statues his entire life, and he's not prepared for moving targets.
He does
maybe.
Kill that lady, though.
He does. Her,
and she's, like, running, like a running target.
Yeah. And that's long distance, too.
Yeah. Through trees. Yeah. He curved the fucking bullet.
Yeah, he had to, like, lead that shot.
Yeah, like, it was, like, wanted in here.
He's also, like, you know, incredibly blindly loyal. Like, the guy's trying to, one of the other, like, lowly henchmen is trying to get out of the vault that they're in with the bomb, or disable the bomb, and like I dropped the whole no, this bomb's going off.
Yeah, willing to die.
We are going to die so that
like you can make money.
So that Goldfinger, because he hired me to do this.
Yeah. I also think it's weird that as far as the Nintendo 64 GoldenEye scale goes. Oddjob is for some reason like 4 feet tall in the game when he like the actor was 5'8".
Yeah, he's
and
huge.
I'm pretty sure they just mixed him up with Nick Knack from the Man with the Golden Gun, Hervey Villachez.
Yeah, I was when I watched that I was like, wait, why is he so big? Because yeah, like you said, growing up playing GoldenEye, I was like, oh, Oddjob's a little dude.
Yeah, also. He's like a dwarf. Oh, but we should it'd be a crime to not talk about it, pussy galore.
Oh, is that her first appearance?
Yeah, no, yes. it's first and only. I mean.
First and only. Oh, she hasn't come back.
She's only in Goldfinger.
Okay. They're the ones who dropped the gas that knocks out everybody.
That's right.
Which the actor who played Goldfinger was extremely uncomfortable with, because the scenes of him like gassing American military made him extremely uncomfortable because he was actually a member of the Nazi Party at one point, and he was terrified that this was going to come out and that. Like, it was going to ruin his acting career with him, like, gassing Americans and laughing about it in film.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really intense.
Nazi. I had no idea.
It kind of all adds up.
Wait, was he, like an Oscar Schindler Nazi? Like, he was
a member of the Nazi Party.
Okay. That's probably...
In Germany.
Probably not.
Well, I think a lot of people were.
Yeah.
I mean, that
and a lot
really
of people disowned
anything.
It afterward, right. But...
But I really want to talk about Pussy Galore because, believe it or not, she's actually my number one.
Cool. Not really.
But now let me explain. Now, not in like a hotness factor. Like she's certainly not. I mean, Honor Blackman, she's attractive.
She is,
for sure. But like she's not the hottest Bond girl. But in my mind, I mean, I explain it as like she's the one, especially this time, the one Bond girl that seems to like have a personality and like an actual like character arc.
Yeah,
that's fairly deep. I mean, it's sort of hard for me to like tote. Goldfinger is like a feminist movement manifesto because like he's fucking smacking her all like so I can't really defend that, but like I think what I like best about it is she's actually like resisting Bond.
Yeah,
I mean until he like
fucks her
like he throws her around in the hay and like kiss rapes her and like you know
he's like strangling her as he's kissing her
and she gives up. But I really like their dynamic. I mean, to me, she sort of has that personality that Bond has, that kind of sort of like cockeyed smile, and really I feel like she's like one-to-one with him.
Yeah,
like she's almost like a partner rather than like some bitch Bond just like has sex with.
Well, she's also like that first introduction to the kind of, you know, funny Bond girl names that we'll be seeing much later. You know,
the
like
subtle,
Plenty O'Toole and On a Top.
Going back to the iconic aspect of Goldfinger, the painting of the woman, completely gold, which is also, I guess you could say, it's referenced in a later Craig movie,
Quantum
of Solace,
Strawberry Fields is covered in oil.
That's we definitely need to mention that.
It's definitely one of my most iconic images. I mean, we watched a lot of fucking movies over 2.5 days, and that's like, that is undoubtedly one of the top images burned into my head.
Well, to me, that's just one of those things that, like, even if you haven't seen the movie, it's like, you know that image. You've seen it. You're like, it's in the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
They had originally wanted Orson Welles to play the part of Goldfinger, but they couldn't afford him at the time. And then he ended up coming back in something probably for a significantly lower rate, because at the time he was... not as sought after.
I wouldn't want him fucking up Goldfinger with all his magic tricks and all that stuff.
Yeah. And also, I think that we can't really leave out Shirley Bassey and her involvement in this one.
Wait, who was that?
The theme song.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
Oh,
right.
I was trying to think of a Bond woman. I'm sorry.
Yeah, like, no, she was. She ends up coming back for both Moonraker and for Diamonds Are Forever. Like, all three of those songs, although iconic, are not my favorite. I think Goldfinger of the three is my favorite, but you recognize her as soon as you hear the song.
Yeah,
like, she's undoubtedly connected with the Bond franchise.
Have we mentioned yet the Maurice Binder doing the opening credits last two movies? And who would continue to do them for the next, like...
million years. Yeah.
He set the framework for every Bond film after that.
And they still follow it, too.
That was great.
There were a couple dips in there as far as, like, ingenuity or doing something interesting with that concept. But it is there to stay.
I can just picture Maurice Binder with cigarettes, like, yeah, I'll fire another fucking title. Like, phoning it in hardcore. Yeah, put some naked chicks, whatever.
We'll project something onto them, silhouettes. We'll slowly, but surely over the years, have their clothes taken off.
It's only 65 right now, but 20 years from now, those chicks will be fully naked.
Which came to fruition.
And then, of course, I should mention Goldfinger dies one of my favorite villain deaths.
Oh, out the airplane.
Flying out the airplane.
Because that's what happens when a hole is open in a plane. You get sucked out like it's space.
Mind you, he flew out a window.
Yeah.
He squeezed the window.
He was
badass, goes through that fucking window.
Yeah.
And he's playing his golden harp in heaven or whatever.
Where's
Goldfinger playing?
So he went to heaven? I don't know. Is that what he said?
Yeah.
So he strikes like thunderbolt.
So that brings us to the next movie, which was Thunderball.
Number two with a bullet for me. I love that one.
Oh, it's your second favorite?
Yeah.
Oh, why? Well, why is that?
It's just damn great. The idea of stealing the warheads and then hiding them and holding for ransom, and even the way they do it by getting a man to look like another man, it's very compelling.
Thunderball is actually... Although, for some reason, even though I liked it, it's not one of my favorites, but the last 30 minutes, to me, the whole underwater battle was amazing.
Very impressive.
I know some people thought it wasn't as good. I'm looking at you, Pat.
Well, I just made the point that Jackson has made this point, too, that we respect the ridiculous task of choreographing this enormous fight scene with all of these... participants, like, and having people get stabbed and all the effect shots, like,
the shots are so wide.
Yeah,
like, you can't deny how impressive
the fact that at any given point you're watching 15 people in scuba gear literally wrestle with each other underwater or be impaled by things. But I think the point I made recently was that you can make a movie about a guy standing on his foot for 2.5 hours, and just because it was difficult doesn't mean that I'm going to be entertained by it. And I think that scene, as difficult as it may have been to produce, was not especially entertaining, because none of these people have any bearing on the story. The only person I care about is James Bond.
He's
in there in some, like, insert shots where he's just kind of watching what's going on, and he's not as big a participant in the fight as I think would have helped.
Touché.
And this is also the scene where he has the breather, the air
breather
thing that he got from Obi-Wan or whatever.
Phantom Menace.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The leaf that you put in your mouth. But it was supposed to give you like an extra 4 minutes of air, and it's just like basically a harmonica that you jam in your mouth.
Yeah.
And I guess like some like British special agent guy had been working on developing one for a really long time for this rebreather. And he went to the producers, and they were like, how did you do it? How did you make this thing work? And they're like, the actors were just holding their breath.
Wait, so he bought it all? Like, for real?
Somehow, he believed that the movies... apparently, it was a big secret that Hollywood fakes things at the time.
Well, I think this was the first movie where we really had sort of differing opinions. Like, it felt like some of the room was like, yeah, fuck yeah, Thunderball, here we go. And then, like, some people were not really feeling it.
Yeah. In our defense, most of us had gotten about 2 hours sleep at the time. And it was coming up on 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, this is probably when, in terms of doing marathons, this is when we were starting to get tired. I mean, we had a lot of second, third, 15 wins.
I definitely napped through a good portion of this. Anything that didn't have Domino in it, who is easily my number one Bond girl,
Yeah, that's the thing. Thunderball has, like, the hottest ladies, like, right. without a doubt.
Hands down, Domino is my number one. She is uncontrollable.
We talked about Domino for, like, 20-something hours.
Yeah.
We continued talking about her, that's right.
I'm still talking about her. But she, like, her, what was the actress's name?
Claudine Auger,
something like that.
But believe it or not, I looked it up online. They dubbed her voice throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, Domino is the same voice as Honey Rider and the girl from You Only Live Twice. All three of them were done by the same woman.
It's like some generic French lady, I guess.
Oh,
like,
really?
Yeah.
So all three of those actresses had the same ADR?
Yeah. But I've seen a lot of bad looping.
Yeah.
Like, it's actually not...
She changed. She had different accents for the different characters.
Yeah.
And also, she was what is the guy's name? Gert Frobe that played Goldfinger.
Yeah.
She was his dialect coach with Goldfinger actually, because I know he was German, but he was supposed to play like a specific area of it, and she was there to help him get the accent right.
I thought his character was supposed to be English, but was raised in there. I don't know.
Well, maybe too much of the German came
through. If I may interrupt.
Apparently she's a terrible dialect coach.
It sounded like that dude from Last Crusade, like that's like trying to be American, but like clearly European. It's like Euro-American accent.
And he shows up later in the series as well, playing another thing.
That's true. But luckily he's a bad guy, so it's like, who gives a shit? Like,
yeah.
Another good thing about Thunderball is we have that great opening scene with the fake funeral. You think he's getting ready to punch out this widow and pay his respects.
My gosh. With his fist. It's just bam, like just socks her.
But the most exciting thing is that he makes a getaway out of a door where there's a conveniently placed jetpack. And then he jetpacks to his car, which was really only like 100 feet away.
It was across the street.
and loads the jetpack into the car where he's got a woman waiting for him. It's just like, oh, okay.
Now, that's a real jetpack.
Yeah. Oh, right? Yes. That's legit.
Authentic jetpack. No cords or anything. Nobody came from the military to find out how they did that.
Rocketeer, man.
They borrowed it from the military.
Eat your heart out, ARC.
But the transition from that, from putting the rocket pack into the car, getting into the car with all these guys chasing after them, they don't leave. They don't make a getaway. He stays in the car, turns on these hoses that spray the henchmen, and then it cuts to the opening sequence.
It's like cops. It's just like spraying around.
That's where you end it? You're just going to get them wet? It's like, what happens next?
Like, did they get away? Did they go to Wendy's? Like, what happened?
Apparently that was enough for the henchmen to say, okay, well, we're wet now.
Did he have the like the rocket thing like prepped? Like it's like waiting for him.
That's
like,
the thing that I love about this is that you don't need a backstory because it's at the beginning. Yeah, you're like, I don't know, whatever.
It's the opening gambit, is what Ivor would say.
Well, it really started a long tradition of like the openings of the movies are like often like the best part of the movie.
Yeah.
Because there's no setup. He just runs in and, like, kicks ass for no reason.
Yeah, you have to explain nothing.
It's almost like the writers were like, wouldn't it be awesome if this were to happen?
And then how do we get into it?
Yeah, how do we get there? I don't know. I just started with it.
Thunderball is actually ranked way high for me as, like, one of my favorites. But I have no idea how much of that is, like, the ones I watched growing up were, like, Goldfinger and Thunderball. That was, like, the ones I always watched. So it could just be the familiarity.
Yeah.
Like, I watched Goldfinger so much that when my family took a trip to, like, Virginia, we went to, it's in Fort Knox in Virginia, right? Or wherever it is.
I think so,
maybe Maryland? I think it's in Maryland. But we were in D.C.
Yeah, yeah.
And we went to go look at Fort Knox, and we were trying to find it. This before, like, Google and shit. And I remember being like, Bouillon Boulevard, there it is. Like, because I remembered his whole, like, thing.
Wow.
I saw Bouillon Boulevard, and I was like, that's it! And we, like, went and found it. So, really, his speech did serve a purpose.
Yeah.
Directing me to Fort Knox.
You were taught by the villain. That's great.
Yeah, it was amazing.
I also wanted to make the point that we found a collection of alternate James Bond songs that were not used. And Johnny Cash had a particularly interesting Thunderball rendition.
I heard that as well.
Because basically, I guess at this point, the series was big enough that artists would get, they were given the title and they could compose a song and submit it to producers.
And they're like competing?
Yeah, competing for a slot at performing a James Bond theme. And Johnny Cash, for whatever reason, thought that, I mean, like, I love Johnny Cash. I listen to Johnny Cash constantly. But it's a British spy movie. and you listen to it, and it's just like makes no apologies for its like Western nature.
Like honky tonk.
Yeah, it's like it's absolutely, it's totally Johnny Cash's style of music, and had Clint Eastwood taken the part as he was offered it, it might have fit, but Thunderball was definitely the Tom Jones one was the way to go.
Tom Jones won that battle.
That's actually pretty high on my list of favorite theme songs, actually.
And I almost feel like he took a significant vocal hint from Shirley Bassey's performances.
Yeah.
Because like the warbling effect of the long notes and everything, like he definitely followed in her footsteps.
Yeah.
The look of love is in your eyes.
So that brings us to 1967.
April of 1967, if you'll recall, in Casino Royale.
The only reason I feel like we should talk about this movie is to warn whoever is listening to this.
Not to rent it.
Actually,
you know what? Do rent it, and then take the DVD and watch the 1954 TV movie, which is included as a special feature.
That's right.
Yes.
And then set it on fire. Yeah. And don't return it to your local video store.
Yeah, who knew that one part of the track was the best part of the DVD? Had anyone ever seen Casino Royale?
I had.
Why did you not warn us
about the horror that we were about to
It was so bad.
Would you have watched it?
Yes. Yeah. I would have been
better prepared.
Asking somebody, a recruit that's been being sent to like fucking D-Day, you're going to warn them that there'll be bullets shot at them.
Yeah, but if I told you that it sucked big time before we watched it, you would have been depressed from scene one. Whereas
I was
this way,
he was.
Okay, from
scene
second 1.5. one. You at least had a 15 seconds of like euphoric joy.
Matthew.
Which I have to now thank you, Patrick, because I did have 15 seconds.
Yeah, you did.
It's the only thing that got me through.
You're welcome.
For anyone who doesn't know, I mean, I doubt most people listening have even seen Casino Royale.
Some may not even know
like
it exists.
Our age, no one's seen it. But like, it's basically, it's Casino Royale, but like spoofed. And you were saying
basically a precursor to Austin Powers, but basically what happened was the people that produced the 1967 one purchased the rights from the television producers from Climax to do this 1967 movie, which features, I think, technically three James Bonds.
More than that.
Every
spy is 007 at the end.
There's like a whole like crew of like women who are like considered quote unquote 007.
But I don't as specifically referred to as James Bond though.
Yeah,
I think there are only three.
Yeah. Like David Niven,
Woody Allen and
Peter Sellers
are the three.
So David Niven is like the original
one true James Bond in it. Yes.
And they kind of allude that he's been James Bond for the entire time that Sean Connery has been like playing the part of James Bond in his honor, in his absence since retiring.
Yeah. And he's upset about how he's being represented, basically.
He doesn't like the misogynist attitude.
So he lets out his anger by throwing concrete balls around with other guys while like a woman plays a trumpet.
We don't have to get very specific.
That's as specific as we should get.
What basically, imagine your worst like bowel movement you've ever had put to like film. That's really what
a terrible angle.
The one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
With music by Herb Albert, which is the best thing in the movie for me.
Well, Albert's score is actually quite good in places, but it can't compensate.
Yeah, cancel out the. And actually, I think Burt Bacharach, I want to say, won a Golden Globe for the look of love in this movie.
Yeah,
I have to say though, as bad as it was, there were a couple things that stood out to me that I enjoyed, and one of the things was Orson Welles sitting there, and while behind him, this gradual like incredible party just seems to erupt. Versus like girls and it's sparklers and it's banners
and
balloons.
He's holding
and
flags.
It just keeps getting better and better behind him, and he's just like, ah, he's awesome. But I think that my favorite part of the whole movie was the weird like cabinet of Dr. Caligari set.
It was like this weird
angular Escher-esque place where everything was gray.
Yeah, even the trees were painted gray.
And it looked cool. It was just a really unique look. And I really felt like, I wish I could have seen more of that.
Well,
that was what, maybe a 3 or 4 minute sequence amongst like 2 hours.
Hours, 20 minutes.
They spent a lot of time conceiving and designing this set to to not use it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, to just, like, put on buffoonery, like, on... Yeah, I'd say, I mean, at this point, like, doing a marathon, there's always a couple of dips. But this was
this was the first wall.
Yeah, this was the wall, in fact.
This was by far the worst movie I've seen in recent memory. Like, this was horrible.
But honestly, it's almost like, it was almost a blessing in disguise. Because, like, for as horrible as it was to watch, it really reinvigorated us for the rest of the day.
Yeah, as soon as
something... Yeah, because we all got a good nap in.
Yeah.
Well, somewhere during this.
I think we were all really grateful that it was over.
We were.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like all the other movies, it's like, oh, thank God this isn't Casino Royale. Yeah. It's like an entertaining Bond movie.
We could put a list together for people of, like, most, like trudging, terrible, like, messes. And then so you put them in order of most difficult to easiest to watch. And this marathon will fly by. Yeah. If you start with Casino Royale. That's the way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, John and I have... You know, if you've heard in the previous podcast, like, that Dan and Jorge run, that amongst us, we've watched a lifetime of shitty movies. It's kind of like a hobby of ours. Yeah. And I'd have to say that amongst the mountain of shit that we've climbed, that was a rough one. That was, like, in the top for me. Just
well, because it's like, not even entertaining in, like, a bad way.
Yeah.
It's not like, ha-ha, this is so bad. Like, it's just, especially, like, bad comedies are, like, the worst.
Yeah.
Because if it's supposed to be funny, it's not. It's like that epic movie, kind of like, oh, like, this is horrible.
It was the precursor. It was like a Bond movie, like an epic movie. Like, it was
true.
Yeah, and you know how those movies, they always say, like, from six of the eight writers of, like, this movie had six directors.
Yeah,
like, that's part of, like, why it was pulled. Yeah, John Huston was probably the best of the directors.
The man that made the Maltese Falcon made this piece of shit. Like,
yeah.
This version of Casino Royale, for me, it is not at the bottom of my list. It's number 24 out of 25 possible.
Really?
I'll tell you which one is number 25 later.
Two movies from now.
Of course. But I'll be the one in the group to throw this version of Casino Royale the most respect. Not a whole lot. But one fact was definitely made clear to me after watching them all. That you definitely have to not be in the mood to watch a James Bond movie to watch this version of Casino Royale. Because compared to the others, it made it terrible. But on its own, if you're a completely different person, then you may enjoy it.
The context
might
have.
Like if you're a corpse.
Well, and a lot, like, I don't know how much of it is, like, it's a thing of its time. Like, people were doing
very
a lot
much.
Of fucking drugs back then. And it's so, like, now it doesn't really translate well for our, like, real quick, like, I think we're so much more, like...
Jaded.
Well, yeah, jaded, and, like, we've just seen so many more movies.
Well, I don't know. I'm actually going to disagree with that, because I like a lot of the people involved with this. I mean, Peter Sellers, to me, is one of the greatest comedy actors ever, and I've seen movies from that era, and I'm in tears, because it's so funny.
That's
Peter Sellers was not funny for a second. Allen was not funny.
Yeah, if you don't like neurotic Woody Allen, don't watch this, because this is him at his, like, absolute, like...
It's a parody of himself.
Straining.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It really is, honestly,
yeah,
like, him trying
true.
To play a Woody Allen, and it's disappointing and not funny, and so I don't know. I don't think it's totally up to, like, a product of its time.
Honestly, I don't think I hated it as much the first time I saw it as I did in the middle of this marathon.
I
don't think that it was professionally produced. Especially considering the fact that in one scene, out of nowhere, and Ursula Andress from Dr. No actually makes a reappearance in this film as the Bond girl.
Oh, that's right.
But she all of a sudden grabs a machine gun and kills everyone in the scene except for Peter Sellers. And you're like, I don't know where this is going. And then she kills Peter Sellers. And he's gone for the rest of the movie. And we don't see him die. We just see her fire again, and then there's no one standing up. Peter Sellers evidently walked off set because of his problems with Orson Welles, and he just wouldn't do the rest of the movie. And
the one smart man in the entire movie.
when the like most accredited member of your cast just like wanders off and is like, all right, I'm done, then you know that the movie's really, like, at the end of the day, not going to be worth having shot.
No. Maybe one of the reasons we're being so harsh is, like, in a marathon... especially having been up as long as we did. I mean, believe it or not, I forgot to mention this, but we started the marathon at midnight because we wanted to just burn through it. So at this point, we're all, like, no sleep, too tired. And in a way, like, I think it almost helps, believe it or not, like, helps you judge the movies a little more harshly Like, it takes quality to, like, keep you interested, and if it's in any way not good.
It's a magnifier. Like, anything that's bad becomes very bad, and anything that's great becomes really great.
That's right.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's going to do it for part one of the Bond Marathon Cinemarathon podcast. Many more movies to go, so if you're still with us, tune in soon for part two, and we'll keep on trucking. Until next time, we'll see you then.